Welcome everyone to this third session of today's conference. This is a roundtable session where we're going to explore the links between academia and action and suggest possible productive links. I won't give long introductions to our speakers because they've all spoken already. I think we're going to go in this order. So Jason Ralph will be going first, then Jane Huckabee, then Zachary Katznelson, Kimberly Hutchins, and finally Julia Hall, and then we will open it up to general discussion. Thank you. Jason.
Okay, thanks. Do I need the mic?
Possibly, yeah.
Okay, when thinking about the relationship between international relations, which is my discipline in academia, and human rights activism, I've noted down two general points and one specific point. Literature and international relations on the relation in the area of human rights activism. When I think about that, I think there's some excellent work out there. And names that come to mind are Keck and Sikink, their book on human rights activism, Activists Beyond Borders, I think is the title of the book, and also Daniel Thomas's work on international relations and human rights groups in the early 1980s, and in the 1980s, with specific reference to Eastern Europe. And I think there's some general points that I drew from this. I used to teach a module called Human Rights Diplomacy, where this work influenced me quite a lot. And what Thomas argues in that book and surrounding articles is that international relations, relations between states, has a very important and influential role in the political space that human rights activists on the ground have. And in effect, what Thomas argued about the 1980s, if you think about in Eastern Europe, was a time where human rights activists did have a major impact on the direction of the reform of a state from the communist regime, of course, to liberal democracies. What Thomas argued was that what he called the Helsinki effect had an important role. And this was a reference to the arms control agreements and the interstate relations between states that were forged in the period of détente in the 1970s, that the diplomats at the time thought would have little or no effect on the work of human rights activists. Yet, we get into the 1980s, and Basket 3 of the Helsinki Final Act was a commitment to human rights. And what Thomas charts is the relationship between détente at the interstate level and the space for liberalisation within the state. And I think this is important. I mean, he argues that if states are getting along in their interstate relations, if they're not calling each other axis of evil or evil empire, as was the case in the 1980s, if states are getting along and if there's détente at an interstate level, then regimes like the communist regime in the 1980s are a bit more relaxed about what's going on internally. And they don't see criticism, they don't see human rights activism as a threat to their own regime. Well, they might see it as a threat to their own regime, but they don't see it as a foreign threat. So they're a bit more relaxed with their internal policies. Now, I mention this because I think it is an area of academic research in international relations that relates to this question of international relations, the discipline of international relations and activism. But also, I think it's, identifies what might be an interesting, a different aspect to the issues we've been talking about today, and indeed some of the issues that have gone forward in relations between the United States and illiberal regimes, regimes that might not respect human rights. And I think there's an interesting question, take for instance Iran right now. Labelling of Iran during the Bush administration as a member of the Axis of Evil, what did that, we know what it had, what kind of influence it had in relations between Iran and the United States at the government level, but what influence did it have on the space that human rights activists within Iran, pro-democracy movements in Iran, what impact did it have on their political space? And if Thomas's thesis is believed, then because interstate relations, international relations between Iran and the United States was harmed in that period, then there was less space for pro-democracy human rights movements on the ground. So that's the first general point I'd make about how international relations research relates to the experience of activists. The second general point that came to mind when thinking about the relationship between international relations and international and human rights activism is something that I've been trying to work on in my own research for the past few years, which is bridging the interdisciplinary divide between international relations and international law. And I think this is important because there's a wealth of material there. But also it's important in the context of this discussion because I think, as we've seen today, NGOs, human rights activists, speak the language of law. It's how they hold governments to account. And if international relations academics are to get involved in that kind of issue, then I think they would be assisted by more interdisciplinary research and the international law, perhaps making it easier for international relations academics to be able to do that. It is difficult for academics who are trying to make their name in one discipline to then jump across the disciplinary divide. Kinds of professional risks there, but I think it's well worthwhile because the real issues of human rights often are discussed in the language of law. And also, as we've seen over the past few years, not just in the questions we've been discussing today on detention, interrogation, rendition, but also in the interstate relations, law has been politically powerful in deciding, for instance, whether it was right to go to war against Iraq. Particularly in this country, the debate on whether it was legal or not, it might not have had an impact on explaining the decision to go to war or not, but it certainly had an impact, as far as I could tell, on the debate and the decision of people to either support it or not. So Gore is a very influential political football, if I should call it that, as well as being important in connecting to NGOs. So I guess what I'm saying here is a plea for more interdisciplinary research across international relations and international law as a way of connecting for international relations to connect to activists. The final point is perhaps a more specific point on a specific research agenda, I guess, over the next few years that international relations, international law, academics and NGOs and activists can work together. And it picks up on a point that Shami made in the presentation in the last panel, which is how the war on terror might end, whether we are going back to a normal state of affairs from an exceptional period post 9/11, and even if we are, is that good enough? I think this was a point that was also made in the previous panel. Is that good enough, or are there more questions? And I think here academics and NGOs can collaborate profitably in terms of collecting and interpreting much of the data that's going on. My own research assistant that I mentioned in my panel is an international lawyer. She's proved invaluable for helping me to interpret some of the finer details of those OLC documents. But also I think NGOs and activists play can help academics in that dissemination and reaching a different audience, which is ultimately, I think, very important. And this is the final point I'd make, is that if illegality, whether it's torture or going to war in Iraq, if that does radicalise people in Leeds, down the road from the university in Leeds, which is where the 7/7 bombers came from, and Sadiq Khan, as was mentioned earlier, pointed to the illegal war in Iraq as part of his justification for the 7/7 bombings. If illegality radicalises those kinds of people, then I think it's important for academics to be able to reach those people and talk about the law, and talk about the possible changes that are now happening as a process of de-radicalising the work, the links that NGOs have in those communities is invaluable to academics. Collaborating on that level, I think, is an important way forward.
Thank you, Jason. Jane.
Okay, so this roundtable is really dear to my heart and dear to the work of the Centre for Human Rights and Global Justice, because we have a commitment to both the practical implementation of rights norms and then also the development of cutting-edge scholarship. And that commitment is reflected in the fact that we, alongside our centre research capacity, we have, as I mentioned earlier, an international human rights clinic, which we teach at the law school, which really is a means of imparting human rights lawyering skills to students, but through real-life situations. It's, we take on clients, as I mentioned, we conduct litigation on rendition and secret detention. So the two areas are constantly reinforcing one another in our work. And so I thought it'd be helpful to draw upon basically four areas where I think there's been most overlap and where it's been most successful. The first has been, we've definitely been able to capitalise at NYU upon offering a neutral space for NGOs to come together and have a conversation. I mean, as many as you would know from working in the field, that NGOs have different imperatives, they have different funding issues. There are a lot of, the NGO community is not always a harmonious one, and so often choosing where to meet with NGOs can be a very political choice. And so by hosting meetings in the university, we really mark it as a neutral space and enable conversations that would not take place otherwise to occur. The second area that we've really focused on enhancing the overlap has been on trying to identify areas in practice where there is a relative lack of clarity about norms, and to then fill that gap with research. So, for example, actually the area of rendition, on which we wrote a report now 6 years ago, was really in response to the fact that we saw this practice, we saw that NGOs were documenting it, but people didn't have a sense, they knew it was illegal, but no one had a sense of how to really lay out the strands of illegality. And so we, in collaboration with the New York City Bar Association, wrote the report to which Jason referred earlier today as well. I think that's really also important too, because part of what academic institutions in collaboration with NGO community can do is to really emphasise the war on terror, and the acts that inspired the war on terror are not really new challenges, and we can, by bringing the perspective that academic research, particularly the historical perspective of academic research, we can really challenge that idea that we need these new responses to new challenges. In particular, one project in which I was involved was writing with Sir Nigel Rodley, who was the former head legal person at Amnesty International for many years, and he was actually involved in drafting the Convention Against Torture. And we co-wrote a chapter on the role of NGOs in the drafting of that convention, but with the view to informing, like, what were the lessons learned for the current environment as well. So that was an example of where, you know, reflecting on NGO experience, putting it in current context, really was a way of bringing perspective to current debates, we hope. The third sort of role of the academic community vis-a-vis some of the issues that have emerged over the last 8 years has really been in having international human rights clinics and national security clinics be really critical to the NGO community. And I want to give a couple of examples. I think this is a very peculiar US phenomenon, not yet present in the UK, although hopefully there may be developments in that area. So just a number of the cases, particularly when they emerged, were very sensitive cases, like, so, you know, particularly representing high-value detainees, for example. A lot of people that you would expect to be at the front of defending those individuals were not willing to sign up yet. It wasn't safe enough to get involved in representing individuals. And I mentioned, for example, often, like, you would want to recruit pro bono law firms to be involved in representing detainees, but, you know, it took a long time before those law firms came on board to help out with Gitmo representation. It took a long time before they came on board with helping out with high-value representation. Whereas universities, if you're a clinic within a university, you have a bit more freedom, academic freedom to take on these cases. You also have, you're not tied, like, you're not going to have a thunder breathing down your neck asking why you're representing these bad people. So you can actually sort of initiate quite controversial cases early on, and then continue to support those NGOs that were either there from the beginning or come on board to sort of go further. And so, for example, clinics in the United States have done a heap of habeas petitions, have been doing a lot of the FOIA litigation in support of NGOs, and really have taken on a very important role in that regard. And as a result, and this is something that I think is very important, have really contributed to the training of the next generation of human rights advocates and scholars in that process. And so they're already, you know, by virtue of having a clinic and that kind of environment, we're encouraging our students to go forth with the idea that research and practice must constantly be informing one another. The final point, sort of related to that point, is really that one thing that I've noticed in the United States context, and also particularly a little bit in the Australia context, has been that these issues about counterterrorism, human rights, etc., can be highly politicised, obviously, and there's lots of various claims to legitimacy that take place by different actors within that terrain. Being a university gives you an inherent level of legitimacy and also the veneer of neutrality. So you can make statements, there's a certain amount of respect that goes along with a university making a recommendation pertaining to a practice that may not, unfortunately, always be given to an NGO. I'm not talking about whether that's warranted or not warranted, just talking in terms of practice, that speaking on behalf of a law school, really grounding your arguments in law, as Jason mentioned, you know, that has been a very important tool for human rights advocates, obviously for many generations, but that can sometimes get you in the door to particular conversations that maybe your NGO colleague may not get in the door to, or they may also get in the door but then not be given the same sort of hearing. So that's been a very important thing in terms of neutrality and legitimacy. But just to add sort of as a final thing that really the two can't proceed on separate tracks. It's very important, particularly for academics, to really appreciate, for example, victim perspectives, and that's something, again, that you mentioned. Like, if you don't understand what it means to talk to a victim, to talk to their family, to talk to their communities, then your academic research really is happening in a vacuum, and that's very important to have those two be constantly interacting. And yeah, I think that's sort of my experience on where we've found overlap to be most effective.
Thank you, Jane. Zach.
Thank you. You actually just took a couple of my points, but I think there's no question, just to reiterate, the prestige that comes with being in academia, and don't ever underestimate that. If you look at who is chosen to testify before legislatures, if you look at who people listen to, having professor in front of your name or doctor means a lot. at the same time, I think that we share challenges in academia and the law in trying to speak. The languages that we use tend to be very private language. So the essence of being a lawyer is we've created this whole legal system, and you need us as lawyers to help you navigate it. And oftentimes language in academia is incredibly dense. I say this as the child of an academic. My father's a political science professor. And I used to always say to him, why do you use so many big words all the time? You know, and it's just, that's how he writes. That's how he communicates with his colleagues. That's how he talks when he's speaking the language of work. But when you're trying to reach a different audience, and I think in the terrorism context, everything is political. Everything is political. And the work that we do, while I'm a lawyer and I work in the courts, most of my work is not in the court of law. It's in the court of public opinion. And the only way that law firms were able to step forward over the course of the years was because an environment was created by people speaking out in the media, by stories coming out, where there was a shift, a cultural shift, where it became acceptable for people to take on these cases. And the only way that we can achieve that is from people from academia, from the law, from wherever, from the NGO community, speaking in a language that people will understand. And I think it's something that we always we lose sight of sometimes, especially there are all these acronyms, all these things we throw around, but whatever it is, we need to be really careful about who our audience is. And I think it's also informed, as Jane was saying, about by the people we're supposedly working for. And trying to understand, you know, as lawyers, when we take on these cases, you know, I'd worked in prisons before. I never worked with Muslims before. I never worked with very devout Muslims before. I never worked with Wahhabi Muslims before, or people from a certain strain of Islam. And I turned to academia to give me some grounding in that. So before you go into a meeting, at least you have some sense of history, some sense of the culture, some sense of the norms that your clients have. They're going to have their own preconceptions about me. Here's some white Jewish American guy coming in here to represent me, and I'm going to have my own preconceptions about them. And so the key is that we try and at least educate ourselves a bit so we come in with an openness and an understanding. And it's you know, something that in the NGO field we need to do better at. But I think it's you know, we can get that help from the academic community. It's the sense of history, particularly when I need to talk to politicians, if I can talk about the history of torture, the legal history, but also just the very facts of what has happened from the Inquisition, you know, on, it's if you put it in that context, people understand that. People listen. But if I'm in my own little vacuum of the last few years, I don't have that same platform, and it's a real disability for me in arguing on behalf of my clients. I'll stop right there.
Thanks, Zach. Kim.
Thanks. I feel a slight sort of pretender saying anything about this because my own work is very much at the kind of philosophical, theoretical end of the spectrum in the academy, and therefore in many ways there are less clear and obvious ways in which what I do might link with activism. So I'm going to speak at a certain level of generality, and I suppose my first point would be that in some ways the kinds of productive links that can be created will depend very much on what particular kind of issues and what particular kinds of disciplines that you're talking about. But I think it also depends to some extent on being clear about what's different about the academic as opposed to the activist, as well as the ground that they share. We will make, as it were, most productive links with each other when there is a sense of the ways in which the agendas might be different, and therefore the ways in which in some ways it might sometimes mean that we miss each other when speaking to each other. I was thinking a bit, because I suppose the closest that I come to knowing something about this is in my interest in feminist scholarship, which seems to me to be one example of where there has been an incredibly productive interplay between the academy and activism and practitioner communities over the years. And yet there still are also tensions there. So we have a whole branch of scholarship that is in effect the product of activism. But we also have a history in which at various points activists have come back to feminist scholarship and saying, look, you're not speaking in a language we can understand any longer. So it comes back precisely, I think, to some of the points that have already been made. So one very simple thing clearly is that if you want that relationship to remain productive, you have to think about the ways in which you communicate, the language that you're using, and precisely the points about audiences that previous speakers have made. I mean, I think one incredibly important thing that the Academy can help with for activism in the areas we've been talking about today and elsewhere is in terms of it being a space where you can do concentrated and consolidated research over time, which is a very different position than the position people are in when they've got to produce reports very quickly on the basis of what they can find, etc., etc. So having good links through which you can feed in the knowledge that is coming out of long-term academic work into practitioner and activist communities is clearly one way in which you can get a productive link between them. The other thing, and I think this speaks to stuff that's already been said, is that there need to be institutional spaces for the connection between the academy and the activist to be made. I mean, today is one such space, and clearly all of the speakers have also related to other such spaces, and I think that's very much what Jane was saying just now. It's we need to think about how it is that we can create spaces, those of us who are in the more privileged and stable world of the academic community, where often, although not necessarily in the future, things like your job security might be rather more stable. You may know you're still going to be here in a couple of years' time, touch wood, etc. To actually use those to try to help to stabilise the often much more insecure worlds, worlds that are very much reliant on funding, worlds that are that don't have those kinds of institutional securities. So it seems to me that one of the things the Academy in particular needs to take seriously is constructing those kinds of institutional responses. One other thing that I just want to throw in, I think the point about the victim perspectives, again going back to what Jane said just there, is really important. And it seems to me that in a long-term and perhaps more indirect way, one of the ways that the most productive kinds of links can be drawn is through academic research actually trying to turn its perspective around from being too top-down a lot of the time. And that perhaps particularly applies to work in politics and international relations. So that idea of a victim perspective, which I think is something that also comes out of feminist research, could be something that the Academy could take more seriously and then can build on that productively in relation with activists and people pursuing particular goals. I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Kim. And finally, Julia.
Well, I'll start with a story, of course. I was at the Baldy Center for Law and Social Policy, which is located in the University of Buffalo Law School, is one of these spaces. It's located in a law school, but it is an interdisciplinary center. And they were trying to bring together academics and lawyers to talk about issues related to violence against women. And I think this may be an area where there's opportunity and where it's very, very contentious as well. And I was paired for an initial conversation as I had just started a small law center to help women who are victims of domestic violence seek control, orders of protection and other things. I was paired with an anthropologist who'd just done a very big study on domestic violence in Hawaii. And we sat down to talk, and I said, well, why don't you begin? And she said, you know, in Hawaii, women and men routinely beat each other. And it's very interesting. And it's actually a means of communication, and there's a reason for the beating, and there's this and there's that. And I remember in that, just that flash of a moment, it occurred to me what different terrain we were treading as an academic who saw this I saw violence and abuse and a court order, and she saw something so completely different And we actually couldn't bridge the gap over the week. We couldn't bridge the gap. There were things that were culturally specific to the use of violence in Hawaiian culture that interested her as an academic. That was her job, was to be interested by that violence. And it was not her job to stop the violence or to, although she inquired about the effect of the violence on both partners, she wasn't really that interested in the hurt so much as what the hurt was supposed to communicate vis-a-vis that relationship. So it was fascinating, really, really fascinating. And I do think on women's issues, often, we find terrain that is deeply problematic. And one of the ways I think the human rights community has been well served vis-a-vis women's rights is by academic research on women in Muslim societies, on Islamic scholars who have given us a better window into cultural practices, family configurations, ways that women perceive themselves, ways that men perceive women in Muslim culture, that have helped us enormously in the last 8 years to understand more. It's given us a window into Muslim societies and has really helped in the counterterrorism context, not least in work related to control orders, understanding the way family configurations work in some communities where we would not have otherwise had a window without the academic research on Sharia law, on cultural norms, etc. I think our work would have been deeply impoverished on human rights, in human rights, if we had not had that kind of research. Now, having said that, I can see the ways that we have benefited in the activist community. And I mean, let's be clear about what we mean by activists. We are not grassroots activists. We are not on the ground protesting and beating down the doors and burning Bush in effigy. We may have thought of it, but we are not doing that. We are activists in a very rarefied strata of activism, right? Almost on the Human Rights Watch, for example, is almost on the think tank end these days, doing quasi-academic work. And in some instances, I and others in this activist organization have published in very well-respected academic journals. So at that level, we're looking at a very gray area. Who's an activist? Who's an academic? Who's a both? Who's a sometimes this and a sometimes that? On the other hand, there is an activist community, a grassroots activist community, that is completely separate from what we do. That activist community is at the grassroots level. It's in the communities. It's staying in touch with the victims. We often use, to be quite frank, those activists to get to the victims. So let's, you know, in unpacking what an activist is, I think it's really important to remember that, you know, we're in a very rarefied atmosphere. Which leads me to my next and last point, and that is I have wished in the course of the last 8 years that as much as my own work in particular, and I know others at Human Rights Watch's work, has been informed by academia, I think we have been somewhat less satisfied about whether our work has informed academics. The idea that you neutrally somehow unpack an issue without understanding not just the voices of victims, but the reality, the political reality on the ground, the dangers that people are in, how your work will be used, because you do have status as an academic that I do not have as an NGO actor. And you will write something theoretical or philosophical or even based on some research, and not really because you're not out there watching all the actors who are ready to pounce on your work and use it to justify bad practices. I think sometimes the academic work that has come out in the course of the war on terror has been misused. And it has been misused precisely because sometimes the academy doesn't have its ear to the ground in terms of who the relevant actors are and how their work might be misused. We've certainly seen that on the preventive detention front. We have absolutely seen it on the issue of cruel and inhuman integrated treatment. We've also seen it with respect to the issue of diplomatic assurances, where we have well-meaning academics trying to unpack a very big issue without a lot of empirical research, whose work is now being used by the British government to justify returns based on diplomatic assurances. And I'm absolutely certain that those academics had no idea that their work would be so misused. And so those are just some, you know, those are just some kind of very diffuse thoughts on this topic, and certainly open to questions as well.
Thank you, Julia. A number of the sessions have run over time, so we don't have many minutes left. I won't ask members of the panel to respond, but I'm interested to receive any comments and suggestions. If you could be brief, s'il vous plaît, madame.
Hi, thanks for the conversation. Just two very quick points. Firstly, I felt there was one actor perhaps missing in the conversation, and that is no one really talked about how to approach governments, with the, perhaps the exception of Zach, to a certain extent, who did talk a little bit about congressional academics and Congress. I mean, should we be teaming up, or you know, do we each approach it separately? Anyways, I just felt they were it was kind of the 800-foot gorilla in the room. And the second question, Julia, I mean, that is a really interesting point. I mean, I would say if with regard like with regards to academics using the work of NGOs and not always coming out very well, I would actually just call that bad scholarship. But more importantly, I mean, I don't think I could have done my PhD without the work of, you know, AI and Human Rights Watch because of the reports that they produce. And these are incredibly valuable. And if you look at any book written on the war on terror, they're going to salt list multiple reports of these organizations. So, I mean, if it's coming out badly, I would probably blame the scholarship. But I the appreciation for the consequences is certainly there now, at least.
Though I've only been in opposition politics, I can only imagine that in government things are even more difficult. If there's sort of one thing that's quite important in approaching politicians and getting your case across is be brief and be simple. And I think Zach's point about avoiding jargon is so important because as well as human rights activists, there are a whole slew of people who you could call them sort of anti-human rights activists who argue for repressive governments or for companies that have close relationships with those repressive governments or for security services who are keen to suppress some work by human rights activists. And they will seize on any appearance of sort of otherworldliness from academia to argue that these people have no experience of realpolitik and it is us in the security services or us who have business people on the ground who are the people who know the reality of the situation.
Thank you. Elizabeth.
Thanks. It's really a question to the two IR panelists. I was wondering if it was possible to reform the teaching of research ethics in the subject areas which could include human rights so that victim perspective or perhaps also the NGO perspective could be taken into account, particularly where academics are interviewing victims and witnesses.
Any other contributions? Yeah, by all means.
But I'm only a student of anthropology, first year, in fact, so I'm not representing this domain as such. But one of the things that I picked up on Julius Hall's speech was that it's anthropologists often find this self-regulatory and completely explainable dynamics between people, and even the violence is normative, or it means different things to what we perceive as violence. And it's really interesting because from the works I've been reading lately, from the more modern ones, it's been appearing to me that there's this tendency in anthropology now to explain it within the universe of discourse only of the people they are studying. So when there's what we would perceive as a violation of human rights, for example, or cases of violence, this would not be referenced even to human rights or like violence from our point of view, but only it would be just reference to what people perceive it as. And it's really interesting because this is exactly what was mentioned before by Professor Hutchings, that like we should maybe have more bottom-up perspectives, but these are the scholars that provide us with the bottom-up perspectives with very like quite elaborate methodology and quite consistent methodology of fieldwork. But then on the other hand, they are so often enclosed in this universe of native of people that they study that they are not quite comprehensible or translatable into our terms. And it's just a comment about like what strikes me about anthropology on the other hand and activism, that this is why anthropologists often don't want to cross this border, I think, between research and activism.
Thank you very much. A very interesting contribution. You're obviously being very well looked after in the anthropology department, which is good news indeed. I think on that point we will conclude. There is another session after this, a plenary session, when members of the audience can ask any questions relating to the various issues that have been discussed during the day. It leaves me to thank our panelists for their interesting observations.